I thought everything was free in Canada anyway.
Apparently not.
No, Austin. Not. Oh, okay. You missed my intro.
Oh, yeah, I did.
Okay, we're back with another episode of Last Week in Medicine. It's January 13th, 2020, and this is our 8th episode. I'm Stephen Jenkins, and today we are trying something a little different. We have not two, but three co-hosts.
Hello.
So hello, Austin Rupp, and welcome back to the pod, Dr. Danny Babel.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
Hello, hello, everyone.
So, Danny, just so you know, the episode that you recorded is the most downloaded episode we've done so far. And I don't know if it's because people like you better than Austin.
I'd like to take this opportunity. Don't know what I was going to say.
Yeah, I can't really explain it, but it's doing yeah. very well. People maybe people
know.
Are really into vaping.
Sorry, Austin.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's probably
I get it.
It's all right. People like vaping.
But I do think last week's episode will soon overtake it. So
yes.
don't feel too bad, Austin.
But yeah, last week was good.
We're going to do three people today, though. So, yeah.
Great.
All I have written down on my...
Baby Yoda, Danny?
Oh, no. Let's not talk about Baby Yoda.
You guys...
We have to.
Every episode begins with a little blurb about Austin skiing the week prior.
Oh. Yeah.
And then Baby Yoda.
I feel so seen. How about the jazz?
That's oh, let's talk about the jazz.
I know nothing
about
the sports.
So apparently they don't need Mike Conley because they're doing great.
Yes, that's true. Take note. That's all we'll say about that.
Well, haven't they won like 8 in a row or something?
I think they're second in the West now.
How did this happen? They're just playing easier teams.
Sports ball.
I have nothing to contribute to this conversation. However, we have had really good snow this last week, so...
I didn't get any of it, so I actually don't want to talk about
that
this week.
Oh, yeah. He's been working a lot.
Plenty of freshies, though. Face shots, snorkels.
Yeah, just stay off Instagram.
We had a resident actually ask about what size snorkel they should get upon moving to Utah.
Oh, man.
Residents convinced him that he needed a snorkel.
To go skiing with?
For the pow, for the deep pow.
Wow. Didn't know that was a thing.
It was.
Do you use the Avalung?
All right.
Okay, well, there was some good stuff out there this week. So lots of, it was tough to choose, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, but... I did learn, for example, from a JAMA article that folic acid and zinc do not improve semen quality. So I guess you can stop taking those, Austin.
No comment.
Also, there was another article in that same issue of JAMA meta-analysis that showed there was no significant association between the use of baby powder in the genital area and ovarian cancer. Which is important.
Kept me up at night.
Because, no, I mean, this is good news for companies like Johnson & Johnson who have been sued multiple times for this. In fact,
have
in 2018,
really?
A jury ordered them to pay out $4.7 billion to 22 women who claimed they got ovarian cancer from using Johnson & Johnson.
No way.
Baby powder. I mean, maybe they won't get sued anymore because of that paper. So I don't know.
Powder it up all
Data
you want.
Data is meaningless, though, right?
Wow, that was a great way to segue into your article. So Austin, you're gonna start us off. What do you got for us?
Yeah. Anyway, okay. So I'd like to talk about an article about hot spotting. Danny, this has nothing to do with dank vapes. Sorry. So the article is called "Healthcare Hot Spotting: A Randomized Controlled Trial." It's written by Dr. Finkelstein and colleagues and was published online in the New England Journal of Medicine on January 9th. So, the article investigates whether or not hotspotting is an effective way to reduce admissions among superutilizers. Superutilizers are patients that interface with the healthcare system the most. Strikingly, 5% of the population accounts for 50% of annual healthcare spending in the United States, and the top 1% of utilizers account for almost 25% of healthcare spending. Pretty shocking, and I think we all know some super utilizers.
Oh, yeah. They're our friends. I mean, people say you can't have continuity of care as a hospitalist, but that's just not true.
Are they wrong?
Yeah.
You got it. Anyway, hotspotting refers to the use of real-time data from hospital admissions to identify superutilizers and where they live. And hotspotting in healthcare was first conceived by a dude named Jeffrey Brenner in Camden, New Jersey in the mid to late 2000s. He built this group called the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers, henceforth referred to as the Coalition. And Atul Gawande published an essay in the New Yorker in 2011 that explored and explained hotspotting and how it might be used to investigate healthcare delivery and reduce costs.
Yeah, I remember reading that. That was a pretty hot article.
Yeah, Gawande is a...
pun intended.
Yeah. Anyway, Brenner was sort of the first guy to get published with, or like, you know, get publicized with this, but other groups were kind of doing the same thing at the same time. Gawande explains it in the following way. He says that Brenner, his team, and other organizations were looking for the most expensive patients in the system and then directing resources and brain power towards helping them. So they use an intensive face-to-face care model to engage patients and connect them with appropriate medical care, government benefits, community services, and aim to improve their health and reduce unnecessary health care utilization. This model was called the Camden Core model and has received lots of attention and funding since Gawande's essay. It was, you know, heralded as a promising, data-driven, relationship-based intensive care management program, but data showing the model's efficacy are limited and observational. So this study in the New England Journal sought to investigate the coalition's model and its effectiveness. With me so far, hotspotting, yeah. Super yeah. Utilizers, Camden Core.
Yeah, what,
I'm here
what did
for
they
it.
Find?
Yeah, well, don't jump the gun, Danny.
Sorry.
So.
We're not ready to talk
we're
about
ready.
Results.
We have a lot more. So.
Okay. More background.
Background, yep.
Oh, still in background.
They randomized 800 patients to receive the intervention or not. Patients were recruited from the hospital, and they had to have at least 2 admissions in the previous 6 months and at least 2 chronic conditions. They also had to have 2 of the following: take at least 5 outpatient meds, difficulty accessing services, lack of social support, a coexisting mental health condition, and an active drug habit. 2 of those, or homelessness. That's actually not true. Homelessness was one of them. 2 out of those things.
Mm-hmm. So it was 2 total admissions, right? It was like 1
in
6 months prior.
Right, 1 in the 6 months yeah. prior, and then 1 that they were recruited from.
It's pretty, it's not very many.
It's not very many, yeah.
Compared to some people we see.
And some of these things are very, you know, sort of subjective. Lack of resources, et cetera. So mm-hmm. Patients were excluded if they were uninsured, had cognitive impairment, or if they were admitted for a surgical problem or a surgical procedure with an acute health problem, mental health care, or for complications of progressive chronic disease for which limited treatments were available. They note...
Which you could argue is all chronic disease.
That's the definition.
Well, they also limited, people who were getting treated for cancer, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And so they do identify that this only apply, only 0.5% of the Camden population falls within this inclusion and exclusion criteria, but that they account for 11% of the city's hospital expenditures.
Okay.
So the intervention was the Camden Core model, and we've talked about that. They utilized a lot of different people to bring healthcare and resources to patients. Patients were recruited from 2 community hospitals, and it should be noted that they received $20 to take the baseline survey. So take that for what it's worth. The intervention was the Camden Core model, and the control group received usual post-discharge care. The primary outcome was readmission within 180 days, and there was kind of a host of secondary outcomes that you can look up if you want. 18 patients were excluded because they had data that didn't match. Also not supposed to do that, I think, but they were excluded. And the intervention, on average, had 7.6 home visits, 8.8 phone calls, and 2.5 accompanied follow-up visits during an average enrollment length of 92 days. So they were definitely doing stuff. They were out there in the community doing phone calls, going to follow-ups, and interacting with the patients. So overall, the intervention did not have a statistically significant effect on the primary outcome. Didn't work. 62.3% of the intervention group was readmitted within 180 days versus 61.7% of the control group. None of the secondary outcomes or pre-specified subgroups were significant. It seemed like, however you slice the pie, there really weren't differences between the intervention and the control groups.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically say that the previous observational data was positive or was remarkable or significant because of regression to the mean.
Mm-hmm.
The super utilizers, if you look at their previous 6 months admission numbers and then the post 6 month admission numbers, there's a significant change. But if you look at 12 or 18 months before the intervention, there were not significant changes. So kind of disappointing, you know. It shows how hard it is to meaningfully and durably help this population. You know, they do point out that the Camden Core model targets a specific population and shouldn't be compared to other populations, like a chronic care cohort of patients. And then they, you know, note that they were underpowered, or that the study couldn't detect potentially clinically relevant but unmeasurable stuff like interpersonal relationships, trust in the healthcare system, etc. But kind of disappointing.
So the readmission rate for the control was also 60-something percent?
62% for both.
62% for both.
Is that kind of high? Or, like,
yes,
over
half? Yes, I would, say that's high.
Super utilizers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was interesting that it looked like 40% of people in the intervention arm had a coexisting substance abuse diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many interventions were targeted specifically to address their substance use disorder. That would be... I didn't see that it mentioned that, but certainly that's something really important to address in these patients.
Yeah. Kind of makes you wonder, like, if, you know, the goal is to reduce readmissions, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, is that really the best outcome or metric to use? I don't know. It sounds like they had a bunch of other secondary outcomes that didn't show any improvement. But, you know, I wonder if you talk to these patients, they would probably feel like the care they got was better.
Yeah,
you know,
I think so.
They probably felt like they had a lot more support, even though there was no difference in how often they got readmitted to the hospital. But I feel like, you know, readmissions can just be such a black box anyway, right? Because it's not always social reasons that bring people back to the hospital, and you can't really fix a lot of their social problems, right? Like, a lot of these patients were homeless, you know, almost all of – oh, wait, they excluded homeless patients. I take that back.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them were unemployed, like 95% of them.
Yes.
And I guess, I mean, they did comment that they had lack of stable housing. So maybe they weren't homeless, but maybe they were, like, you know, constantly at risk of eviction or something. I don't know. So there's, like, so many factors, right, that go into it.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that's the point of the Camden Core model, is to address kind of all of those factors.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, maybe the main takeaway is that addressing all of those factors is really, really hard, despite.
Yeah.
You know, a really great effort. And, you know, Gawande's essay is much more sort of humanistic and, like, makes you feel good because, like, these patients, you know, trust their providers, and, you know, the RNs and LPNs and MAs, like, make durable, lasting relationships with the patients. And I think, you know, doing this probably makes you and the patient feel good, but maybe doesn't actually change the bottom line all that much.
Mm.
And they did, you know, I'd have to dig in again on the secondary outcomes. They looked at some surrogates for costs overall as well.
I wonder if the results would change if it was over a longer period of time, like a couple of years.
Maybe. I mean, I think one of the things they point out is that regression to the mean, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
those patients they selected, they just barely had a previous hospitalization in the last 6 months. Then they had this other one. And so you could maybe predict that they would keep having them, but most of them actually kind of stopped getting readmitted.
Yeah.
And so... that, you know, that's why I think the control arm and the intervention arm ended up with the same number of readmissions, is because that was going to be the natural trajectory for their readmissions.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's an interesting paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, it makes you realize that the social determinants of health are just complicated and there's no easy fix for it, right?
You didn't know that.
But it doesn't mean we shouldn't try.
Right, agreed. I think that's a big point.
Yeah.
Keep trying.
Keep trying, Camden. We believe in you. All right.
Yeah, it was a good effort on their part.
Dr. Babel, you got the next one.
Yeah, so this is a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And the first author was Dr. King, a study that took place in Korea, looking at very severe asymptomatic aortic stenosis and whether or not we should do surgery on these people. If you guys didn't already know, aortic stenosis is the most common valvular disease for which surgery is indicated in developing countries. Currently, guidelines say if a patient's symptomatic with their generally severe aortic stenosis, we should do surgery on them, just as a short review, symptoms generally being syncope or presyncope, angina, and dyspnea. If unrepaired, these symptomatic patients have a really terrible natural history. The expected mortality is 8 to 34% annually for these patients. They live about 2 to 3 years after becoming symptomatic. So pretty dismal natural history, and that's why we do surgery in these patients. It's a little bit less clear whether or not we should do surgery on those patients that are asymptomatic, and there have not been any randomized trials looking at this. There have been some observational studies looking at specifically very severe asymptomatic aortic stenosis, and they've been favorable in terms of doing early surgery. And the difference between very severe and severe aortic stenosis, as you guys probably already know, are just in the numbers. The aortic valve area is 0.75 centimeters squared in contrast to 1 for severe. The peak aortic jet velocity is 4.5 meters per second in contrast to, I believe, 4. And then the mean transaortic gradient is 50 or greater in the very severe aortic stenosis patients. So basically, we just don't have a lot of, we did not have a lot of data prior to the study on when was optimal to do aortic valve repair in these patients, or should we just watch them conservatively.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, this trial is looking at surgical aortic valve replacement, not transfemoral. Transcatheter, which is a different population of patients. So this was the randomized comparison of early surgery versus conventional treatment in very severe aortic stenosis, or the recovery trial, again taking place in Korea. It was a multi-center randomized parallel group open label trial involving asymptomatic patients who had very severe aortic stenosis as defined by the parameters I mentioned earlier. Patients had to be 20 to 80 years of age. They obviously had to be surgical candidates because they were going to be randomized to potential surgery. They were excluded if they had anything that would obviously fast-track them to surgery, like having symptoms or having an EF less than 50%, which is also an indication for surgical repair in patients with aortic stenosis, or if they had any clinically significant aortic regurgitation or mitral valve disease, or if they had undergone cardiac surgery previously. For the patients that had sort of nonspecific borderline symptoms, they actually did exercise testing to see if they potentially had symptoms from the aortic stenosis, and they were excluded if they had positive stress tests. So patients were randomly assigned in a one-to-one ratio to either early surgery or conservative care. And those that were assigned to the early surgery group ended up getting aortic valve replacement within 2 months after randomization, so pretty quick. Their primary endpoint was a composite of operative mortality or death from cardiovascular causes during the follow-up period, and they followed them up at least 4 years after the last patient was enrolled. Their secondary endpoints were death from any cause, repeat aortic valve surgery, clinical thromboembolic events, and hospitalization for heart failure. Analyses were generally performed on an intention-to-treat basis. So patients were enrolled from July 2010 through April 2015. There were 145 patients ultimately enrolled and randomly assigned. Interestingly, there were 2 patients in the conservative care arm that crossed over to early surgery, and vice versa, there was 4 patients assigned to early surgery that crossed over to conservative care. But then those patients ended up getting surgery anyways. The majority, or 61% of these patients, had aortic stenosis related to bicuspid aortic valve.
Mm-hmm.
So surgery was performed successfully in all the patients that were assigned to it, 50-50. 50% got a mechanical valve, 50% got a biologic prosthesis. In the conservative care arm, interestingly, 74% ended up undergoing surgical aortic valve replacement or TAVR during the long follow-up period because they then developed symptoms.
Yeah. And only 1 got TAVR, right?
Yes, only one got to run. The rest got surgery. So basically, they found that the primary endpoint, which was operative mortality or death from cardiovascular causes, again, was lower significantly in the early surgery group versus the conservative arm. It was 1% at both 4 and 8 years in the early surgery group, as compared with 6% at 4 years and 26% at 8 years in the conservative care group. And notably, the estimated rate of mortality for asymptomatic severe aortic stenosis, not very severe, is 1% mortality. So interesting comparison. They said the number needed to treat to prevent one death from cardiovascular causes for 4 years was 20 patients. So pretty favorable numbers there.
Yeah, and the operative mortality was death within 30 days of having the surgery, right? And they didn't have anyone die within 30 days of surgery.
Yeah, very good
in either
outcomes.
Group, in the conservative arm too, right? Which is like kind of amazing. Like, mm-hmm. it must be a really good surgery center that they,
exactly.
that they were doing.
Yeah, and I think some of the limitations, the patients were generally kind of young and healthy. I mean, which sort of makes sense because that's the people that you're going to do surgery on. And a lot of them had bicuspid aortic valves, so maybe not as applicable to a more sick population, an older population, mm-hmm. and certainly to a center that maybe isn't doing as many of these surgeries because, again, as you mentioned, their surgical outcomes were quite good.
Yeah, so then the people that did have the composite outcome in the intervention arm, it was just one person, I think, who had like a cardiovascular death within that follow-up period mm-hmm. versus was 11 patients in the conservative arm, which I think was 15% of them. So yeah, big difference mm-hmm. there. So yeah, I mean, I think it was a pretty interesting study. I didn't realize, so according to the 2014 AHA ACC guidelines, like there's already a class 2A indication to get your valve replaced if it's very severe. But that was based on those
observational studies,
and retrospective studies.
Limited.
Yeah. So this is kind of the first randomized prospective trial that looked at this. So I wonder if that'll just kind of change the class of evidence in those guidelines. Because I do feel like, you know, I've seen patients, you know, on pre-op or whatever, they have like a super very severe, you know, aortic valve and on their echocardiogram. And so then I have seen those patients go on to get their valves replaced, even though they weren't symptomatic. So I think people were doing it. Now we have better evidence to support it.
Yeah, I think these are pretty compelling results. It doesn't really tell us what to do in the asymptomatic, just severe aortic stenosis patients.
Yeah,
this is really
this
just
was a small subclass.
Severe.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really apply to the TAVR patients, the patients that are not surgical candidates.
Correct. Yeah, pretty low mortality rate, though, overall, even in the conservative arm. Like, makes you wonder, like, are Koreans just so much healthier than Americans?
Probably.
Is it the kimchi? Is that what it is?
Yeah, there's
should we do a randomized control trial on kimchi?
Sure. I'd like to take
I'll be a
place.
Part of that.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, last trial, or last paper, effect on treatment adherence of distributing essential medicines at no charge, aka the Clean Meds randomized clinical trial. This was published in the January issue of JAMA Internal Medicine, originally published online on October 7th, 2019. The first author is Dr. Navindra Persaud from our neighbor up north, in Ontario. It was funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. And the question they set out to answer is, does giving medications to patients for free improve treatment adherence? So there are a lot of factors that go into medication adherence, including side effects, dosing frequency, route of administration, patient beliefs, health literacy, demographics, and comorbidities. But one of the biggest factors is cost. So a 2018 survey by GoodRx showed that one-third of Americans have skipped filling a prescription because of cost. And a 2019 Gallup poll showed that 58 million Americans reported an inability to pay for prescribed medications at least once in the last 12 months. And I think we see this all the time on the wards, right? Like, I got a patient today that came in with a COPD exacerbation, and she like wasn't using her inhalers because she couldn't afford them. And so she was alternating filling her Dulera, and then the next month she would do Spiriva because she couldn't afford to fill both of them. And so, you know, obviously that cost is a big player in medication adherence. And it turns out that Canada is a great place to do a study like this because hospital care and physician care is publicly funded for everyone, but coverage for medications varies by province. And in Ontario, 55% of people have some kind of employer-based insurance that pays for their meds with some copays and deductibles, and 28% are on some form of public insurance with copays and deductibles, and then the rest basically are just paying for it out of pocket. So for this study, the researchers specifically targeted patients who had reported medication non-adherence because of cost in the last 12 months. So they enrolled 786 participants and randomized them to either free meds or regular access, which means they had to pay for them. 395 patients got free medications, and the medications had to be on a list of 128 essential medications adapted from the World Health Organization. The meds ranged from treatments for acute conditions like antibiotics to more chronic conditions like antihypertensives and diabetes medications. And the medications were mailed to the patients from a central pharmacy, and they excluded controlled substances like opioids and sedatives. Because you don't have to worry about compliance with those meds, am I right? The primary outcome was self-reported adherence at 12 months. And so they were going to collect data from a subset of patients with electronic pill bottle cap devices to confirm adherence. But most patients did not return the devices, so the data was incomplete. Yeah. So did the intervention work? Well, the reported adherence rates for the patients who got free medications was 38.2%, compared to 26.6% for the patients who had to pay for their own meds with a p-value of less than 0.001. So yes, I think this paper shows that giving patients free medications could improve adherence. They had some secondary outcomes as well, including systolic blood pressure, which was 7.2 millimeters of mercury less in the free medication arm, and LDL levels, which were not significantly different. They also looked at hemoglobin A1c, which was 0.38 less in the free medication arm, but this was not statistically significant. Hospitalizations, deaths, and serious adverse events were similar between the groups. So what do you guys think? Is this compelling evidence to make essential medications free of charge?
Were the medications also mailed to patients? Or
yeah, they were mailed.
So that could influence because I think it mentions that people are more likely to take meds when they're mailed to them, you know, regardless if they're paying for them or not. But
that's
sure,
a good
if
point.
We could pay for a lot of patients' medications, that'd be great.
I thought everything was free in Canada anyway.
Apparently not.
No, Austin.
Oh, okay.
You missed my intro.
Oh, yeah, I did.
No. Okay. So hospital care is free. Physician care is free. Medications.
Mm. You did say that, didn't you?
Varies by province, right? So
yeah. I mean, I'm still struck by how dismal the compliance is.
Still
right?
Pretty bad.
I mean, it's still 38%. Right?
Yeah, like, and that's self-reported, yeah. So they could be, like, embellishing a little bit.
I mean, that's just not something that we think about enough, right? Like
how to make them take their meds?
Well, just the fact that they're not.
Yeah, but a difference from 26% to 38% is pretty big if you're talking about public health issues, right? Like, if you could get that much better compliance with, you know, hypertensive therapy, think about how many heart attacks and strokes you could prevent from a public health perspective. So,
can we just make all medications cost less?
What?
Well, that's radical. What do you Whoa. Like, a socialist?
Oh, here we go.
Oh, no.
Here we go.
Box.
We decided we weren't going to talk about politics anymore.
That episode was the lowest. Just
no.
Yeah. It's so hard not to sometimes.
Well, I mean, healthcare and policy, they're so interwoven.
Hand in hand.
Yeah.
I mean, two of our articles this week, you know, are focusing on basically socioeconomic, social determinants
your
of health.
Your guys's for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is encouraging. The other one, not so much.
Yeah.
But we just keep coming back to this, huh?
Maybe the coalition should think about giving them meds for free. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, and we do have a lot of our frequent flyers that we, you know, at discharge, I'll give them a full set of medications, and somehow our case managers are able to get it paid for.
That's like 30 days.
And then they
worth.
Come back in 3 months, and we found out they never refilled any of them. And so, yeah, I mean, part of it's, you know, not having the insurance to pay for it. Part of it is, even if you did pay for it, they probably wouldn't take some of these medications. So there's a lot of things that go into medication adherence, but part of it, I think, is buying into, does this actually help me? You know, I'd rather spend my money at Goop, you know, because Gwyneth Paltrow has...
Does she have a store?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can buy all sorts of stuff. Okay, well, does anyone else have anything they want to share?
Well, I was just going to mention an honorable mention. This was an article from BMJ around Christmas, so it was not last week in Medicine. It was a couple weeks ago in Medicine, but I thought it was kind of clever. It was called Q Fever, the superstition of avoiding the word quiet as a coping mechanism, a randomized controlled non-inferiority trial. This was a study in, it looks like, a microbiology department in the UK, and the clinicians were randomized to open an envelope that either said something like, you're supposed to say, today's going to hopefully be a quiet day, and on other days you'd be randomized to basically saying, like, no one could say quiet the entire day. It was just like a ban on that word. And they looked to see if it led to higher patient volume in their clinic. And it turns out that that word doesn't actually increase clinical workload. Really? Sort of refuting the long-held superstition.
This, let's just say that up
that
front.
Is super, super strongly
this is
held.
Pseudoscience.
Still shouldn't say it.
Still shouldn't say it.
Yeah. You guys can take it for what you will, but it doesn't.
I'd like Austin's to see the statistical analysis on this data.
Maybe we should hold our own study. Especially on night float. See what happens.
Yeah, how much FTE can we get? How much FTE did they get for this?
That's a good question.
Okay, well, that's all we got for this week. Thanks for tuning in and making it to the end of the episode. We still failed to get it under 20 minutes, but whatever.
Yeah, only by 12 minutes.
Probably just cut out the entire intro.
You can find us on Twitter at Last Week in Med, and if you'd like to give us feedback, please send us a message. If you enjoyed the podcast, please go rate it and tell your friends.
Take note. Thank you.